This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new Unrivaled League, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to this week's Rookie Roulette. I'm your host, Tyler Metcalf. This week, Alex Sarr, number two pick in the 2024 NBA draft to the Washington Wizards. I have an awesome interview with Matt Moderno from Believe in Wizards and Bullets Forever coming up in a few minutes here. But before we get to that, I just kind of want to run through some numbers about where Sarr is, how he's kind of how his season's gone, and how it kind of compares to what we saw coming into the draft. Now, Sarr ended up at number one on the No Ceilings Collective board. Personally, he was number three on mine. And some of my big concerns are a lot of what we're seeing throughout this year, where he was a really perimeter-oriented player on offense and then didn't necessarily have the physicality and the strength and the rebounding consistency to be that full-time center. And depending on who you asked across the league, the opinions varied widely, where one scout would be like, yeah, no, he's for sure a center. And another would be like, no chance, he's for sure a four. And that's kind of where I got hung up, where it's like, all right, well, you're trying to be a stretch big, but you can't shoot yet. And when you try and be a center, you're not necessarily physical or strong enough yet. So, but the physical tools, the passing flashes, the scoring versatility is all so intriguing, especially in the 2024 draft that had so many questions. So it's like, this guy can't fall past one, two, three, anywhere further. And it's like, what are we doing? We're overthinking it. And we're starting to see that this year as well. Now, the raw numbers and some of the advanced numbers with Sarr are really rough, but he's on a horrible team that's trying to be bad to continue to get really high draft picks. It's to be expected. So when we look at the numbers, they're rough. They're really rough. So when we look at our friends at Synergy, he's in just the 36th percentile spotting up. He's below the 15th percentile as the pick and roll man in transition and on cuts. He's in just the 29th percentile on jumpers, 21st percentile on runners, and 33rd percentile at the rim. The scoring efficiency just isn't there yet. It's tough. When we go over to cleaning the glass, which takes out buzzer beater heaves and garbage time, it's a lot of the same, unfortunately. He's in the fifth percentile in points per shot attempt. And the shot distribution is still that kind of concerning perimeter oriented stuff, where in terms of shot frequency, he's in the 72nd percentile in 3-point attempts at his position, 73rd percentile in mid-range shots, and just the 18th percentile at the rim. Now, if he was shooting really well, that's one thing. But unfortunately, he's not. In terms of shooting accuracy, he's in the 39th percentile from three at 33%. Now, he is at 40% from the corners, which is really encouraging. He's in the 13th percentile on the mid-range. But when we look at the long mid-range jumpers, which hopefully are a sign that he can, in the coming years, continue to expand that out to the three-point line, he's in the 76th percentile on long mid-range jumpers. But then when we go to the rim, this is another issue from even before he got in the NBA, where he was at OTE and FIBA and in the NBL. He's in just this 26th percentile in at-rim finishing at 28%. And and the seventh percentile in effective field goal at 46.5%. The scoring's been tough, but there are signs of encouragement and things to be excited about with Sarr still. The most important, or the most exciting one for me, is the assist rate being at 13.6%, which ranks in the 69th percentile. And Matt and I get into this more, and how this season has to be about the process and not just the end result. If you get hung up on the numbers with Sarr, you're going to be really disappointed. But when you look at his process and compare it to what we saw in the NBL and in Summer League and at the start of this year to now, he is drastically improving and he is rapidly growing as a player. And that's what we hope to see from rookies, especially ones on bad teams that are trying to be bad yet again. Now, additionally, when we look at just his box score numbers, Sarr's averaging 12.7 points on 39.6, 32.7, 64 or 66.4 shooting splits, 6.7 rebounds, 2.3 assists, and 1.5 blocks on the season. Not great. When we just look at the last 15 games for him, though, he's averaging 16.3 points, and this is where we're starting to see some of that improvement with the decision-making, the shot selection, and the effectiveness. 16.3 points on 40.2% shooting from the floor, 37.1 from three, and 76.9 from the line, along with 6.9 rebounds, 2.7 assists, and 1.3 blocks. So aside from the scoring numbers, we're still seeing really solid rebounding numbers, playmaking numbers, defensive playmaking numbers. But recently he's been starting to figure out the shooting efficiency and the shot selection. And that's where the improvement really needs to start. And we're starting to see that. On the defensive end, the defensive playmaking has been really encouraging, especially from a weak side rim protection standpoint. 2.6 block rate ranks in the 78th percentile. Unfortunately, that's kind of the only really exciting aspect. The defensive rebounding is just 16.2% in terms of defensive rebounding rate, which ranks in the 39th percentile. Opponents are shooting 69.7% at the rim, which ranks in the 13th percentile when he's on the court. It's tough, but it's also better than when he's off the court, and that kind of speaks more towards the context. And Matt does a great job of kind of highlighting how some of the perimeter defensive issues with the Wizards have also kind of factored into those numbers. So it's been a bumpy year for Sarr. It hasn't been ideal. He isn't a perfect prospect. He never was coming into the draft, but he's encouraging enough and has enough tools. And we're starting to see more and more of that improvement in the areas that really matter with his game. So long-term, I know if you just look at kind of like a month sample here and there with Sarr, some of it may not be so great. If you only watch Summer League and that's all you saw and you gave up on him, well, first off, don't take Summer League too seriously. But he has been significantly better than any of that. So we're seeing Sarr improve throughout the year, and that should be really exciting for Wizards fans going into this offseason and into next year, especially depending on who they pair with him, whether it's Cooper Flagg or Dylan Harper or Ace Bailey or VJ Edgecombe or Kasperis Jakusconis or whoever at the top of the 2025 draft. They're heading in the right direction. Now, before we get to my interview with Matt, let's pull up the wheel and figure out who we're talking about next week. So we're going to give it a spin here. I love the sound effect. They never get old. And we will, it's about darn time. The Zachary Risacher. We'll be talking about him next week, but that's future us. For now, let's jump over to my interview with Matt Moderno. Making his repeat appearance, you may remember him from the Bob Carrington episode earlier this year, but from Believe in Wizards, he is Matt Moderno. Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to kind of break down Alex Sarr, one of the bigger name rookies in this rookie class from the 2024 NBA draft, obviously. First, thanks for taking the time. Good to have you back, friend of the program now, officially multi-time friend. And before we kind of dive in, just tell everyone where they can kind of find your stuff again and how they can support you, just in case they missed the Bub episode and didn't immediately go follow you.
Yeah, thanks for the intro. Appreciate it. Happy to be back. Means the first one didn't go too terribly, so that's always a good thing. Believe in Wizards, BLEAV. It's myself and former Wizard Jihadi White about once a week talking about the Wizards. Candidly, it's been a little less this season just because there's not a ton to talk about on a week-to-week basis when you're deep in the midst of an all-time tank. But it's been fun to talk about these rookies. And over at Bolts Forever, if anybody wants any more written coverage of the Wizards as well. So that's kind of the two big ones.
Go support Matt. But we are here to talk about Alex Sarr, the number two pick overall pick in the 2024 NBA draft, coming over from the NBL, French forward center. Been around the kind of draft circles for a long time, and it was really intriguing once he decided to go to the NBL. But once, as draft night kind of approached, it became a little more and more obvious that Sarr was going to be the number two pick, because he didn't, I believe he didn't even go work out for Atlanta, and he wanted to kind of steer himself towards the Wizards. No offense, but I'm sure it was kind of refreshing.
It's probably first time for that.
So
maybe
last,
we'll see.
So on draft night, when his name was announced, it wasn't a total surprise, but what was your kind of reaction to the pick, that whole process, and just your kind of initial feelings to having Sarr, with his size, versatility, athletic tools, kind of being the franchise, the building block going forward?
I think it was a little bit of relief, right? Like, of just, okay, this is sort of playing out how maybe we were expecting it to play out, which is, again, not a given. If you're a Wizards fan, that doesn't always sort of go to form. And, I typically have a personal philosophy of 50-50 thoughts on players. I would always default to the wing. That's just sort of the way I go. And, not usually a big, take a big early guy, unless they're some generational talent, which I don't think Sarr is. But he also just seemed like such a no-brainer pick. Like, every NBA team can use that kind of player, at least what he projects to be long-term. So it just seemed like a no-brainer pick. It seemed like the type of guy that this front office would value particularly. So, it playing out the way it was expected to be playing out a couple days before, of just, hey, Sarr doesn't want to go there, the Hawks are going to kind of adhere to that, and the Wizards aren't going to trade out or any of this kind of stuff, and take the guy I think the majority of the fan base also wanted them to take. Just, again, doesn't really happen. I think this is like a misery loves company kind of fan base sometimes, of just like, whoever they take, we'd find some kind of nitpicking opportunity. And this draft really went 3 for 3 for them, for the majority of folks. Obviously, there's always a few dissenting opinions, but I don't think anyone had viscerally negative reaction to them taking Sarr with the number two pick. And, so far so good, I think, overall.
So you kind of say so far so good. Obviously, the season has been what we kind of expected from the Wizards, which is fine. It's kind of nice for them to at least have a clear direction of we're committing to this rebuild now. Exactly. We're going to be bad, but it's more about the process rather than the end results. And regardless of what numbers you look at, not a whole lot of them are very encouraging, but it's all about the process. And was today better than yesterday? So how has your kind of opinion, maybe it hasn't changed at all, but how has your kind of reaction or the fan base's reaction to Sarr kind of evolved throughout the season?
It was pretty dark around here on the last day of Summer League. I think we talked about this a little bit on the Bub episode, but
yeah,
is probably the worst Summer League performance of all time. And there are some real stinkers in an event like that. So there was a certain amount of folks that were ready to just ship him off the island immediately here and just call it a loss. But that's why you don't read too much into Summer League. I think he's been more good than bad, I would say. Again, the numbers maybe don't necessarily back that up, but you just have to look at them in the context with where the Wizards are overall and what they're trying to do. It'd be almost impossible for him to look good on paper, just given, the situation that they've thrown him into here. He's playing with a lot of other rookies. He's playing with a lot of low efficiency veterans that are not, he's not playing LeBron James or somebody that's going to make them all look necessarily better. I mean, Jordan Poole has been better this year, but I don't think he's necessarily the guy that sort of raises the level of all of his teammates. So these are guys that are doing a lot on their own. I have more questions about, honestly, how the coaching staff is intending to use him longer term than I do about him overall. I would say if you took a scouting report from anybody going into the draft here, it's sort of played out, you know, almost exactly the way people expected it to play out. He was pretty raw offensively. Doesn't do some of the big man-y things you would like from a big man, but he covers so much ground. He's really mobile. He's shown the potential to be a stretch big here. I'll use potential there. He's trending in the right direction overall here, I think, which is good. So it just, this is kind of what you'd expect, right? He's a raw rookie with a lot of upside. So he's looked raw and he's shown some upside. So it sounds like really straightforward, but I've just sort of just nod my head along with like, yeah, this is sort of par for the course and really kind of what I expected from this overall experience. I didn't think he'd ever be, you know, as bad as that one summer league performance. And I don't think he'll be as good as the 34 point game against Denver, you know, last week, all that often. So the truth is kind of somewhere in the middle as usual.
So we've gotten his floor and his ceiling all within an 8 month span. You love it. You know, it's like, all right, cool. Now we know, let's aim for the middle. Yep. Okay. I love what you said about the kind of preseason scouting reports. Cause that was exactly going to be my lead in. And that was something I really struggled with Sarri throughout that entire process. He ended up at three on my personal board. Because I was like, okay, like I like that he's willing to shoot it, mm-hmm. but he's not a good shooter. Right. Like I think there's some like very obvious, like mechanical issues that need mm-hmm. correcting. I don't think he's necessarily physical and strong enough to be a five, but he's a little too big and not a good enough shooter to play the four. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what is he? And then you ask NBA people and they're, you know, one will emphatically tell you, it's like, nah, he's a center for sure. And then, you know, the next team will be like, no chance he can play center. And it's like, oh, cool. Glad that we're all on the same page.
Clear that up. Yep. Exactly.
So, and let's start on the kind of defensive end with that thinking of, can he play the full-time five? Because the shot blocking numbers are good. He's in like the 78th percentile in block rate, but it feels like a lot of that kind of comes from more like a help shop rim protection type of stuff, like his weak side rotations, really kind of pinning guys under the rim, like in pick and roll coverage. But then he kind of gets lost in no man's land a lot. The rebounding numbers aren't what you would want them to be. So just specifically on the defensive end, do you think that he's shown enough or has enough upside to kind of be that that building block, that defensive anchor that most teams kind of rely on their centers being?
I don't know if he's like the anchor by himself. I think he's more of like the ultimate complimentary guy that sort of raises the level of the other guys around him, right? Because he's the Wizards haven't had defensive playmakers in the sense of just like Denny Avdija to me was a very good, like, I will guard my man and this is, you know, this is my matchup and I can win this. But he wasn't really the guy that made everybody else look better on that end of the floor all that often. Whereas I think Sarr can do that long term. I think Koulibaly can do that long term. And I think that way you can kind of build this sort of collective approach to overall team defense. And it's one of the things, like the strength of Sarr defensively is that he just can kind of float and cover so much space. But the downside right now is that sometimes he floats and tries to cover too much space. So I think it's going to be really important for them to figure out exactly how they want to, you know, deploy that and work around him. And I think the nice thing is, you know, in certain matchups, he can be, you know, the five that you're looking for him to be. And in certain matchups, he can be this sort of like floaty four that, you know, helps people in space and free safety some. So it just, the nice thing is the flexibility, but that's also one of those things where sometimes that makes things more complicated, right? Like if you have a Walker Kessler, you're playing him one very specific way. And this is how the defense looks around that. Whereas with Sarr, it's like, sometimes you can almost get too creative when a guy can potentially do too many things. And if I were them, I've kind of been advocating for like, start simple. Like, this is what we expect from you. Like, this is the box we're putting you in. And if you exceed that box, like, that's great. And we'll slowly, you know, increase the size and dimension of the box over time here. And it doesn't really seem like they've tried to do that. I think this year has been a lot of just like throw him out there and just let him like bounce around and we'll figure out what he does well and what he doesn't. And, you know, maybe that's for next year is okay. Now that we've kind of like beta tested him a little bit, we can start to put some structure around it. So, you know, they know better than I do. Maybe that's the best way to go about it. But over time, I would like to see, you know, like you don't want redundant skill sets on a roster that's trying to win, but I would love to see them add a big man that at least profiles similarly to how they intend to use him. the Valanciunas thing of that being his mentor, like he was never going to play basketball the way Valanciunas plays. So yeah, like, yeah, maybe he can learn some little tricks about how to better defensive rebound. Sure. But like, let's find a guy that was successful in that role or, you know, somewhat in that role and see if we can, you know, get him to learn a couple of tricks of the trade to play that way. I think that would be a nice, you know, move for them, you know, going forward, is to find someone that can help them. And their lone big man coach on the roster is, you know, former NBA center from France, Alexis Iginsa. And this is just this huge monolithic guy that was parked in the paint. And, you know, it's great that they speak the same language and they've known each other for a long time, but that's just not the way you're going to, you know, expect Sar to play. So yeah, big men can teach big men, but there's also some limitations there in terms of like what he can really extrapolate from Magenta's specific experience. So I would be trying to diversify the voices that are in his ear a little bit long-term.
Yeah, because Alex Sar is, well, hopefully he's never going to be one of these 280-pound centers. If he gets to that weight,
we've done something wrong.
Something bad has gone wrong or is about to go wrong.
Exactly.
No, I think that's a really good point. And it's something that I was always really intrigued with Sar, or kind of really struggled with too, was in his, like, all of his FIBA tape before he went to the NBL. It's like, man, the athletic tools here are really, really encouraging. Mm-hmm. They're exactly what you want from your kind of toolsy, big, you know, 5'4 hybrid. Mm-hmm. But the processing, the awareness, the consistency isn't always there. And then in the NBL, they kind of simplified his role, kind of like you said, and asked him to just play a little more simple and just kind of play drop coverage. Are you kind of concerned? I know you kind of hinted at it, but how concerned are you about that processing kind of coming into fruition or being an issue long term, and some of the complex coverages that they're asking from him? Do you think that that's going to be beneficial long term because he's being exposed to it and just being thrown into the deep end, and it's like, hey, sink or swim, you're going to figure it out or you're not? Or is it just going to kind of form some really bad habits that may not necessarily be correctable or make team building kind of a little more complicated going forward?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And it's the one I wrestle with the most, right? Of just like, okay, it's cool that you're just like letting him play and seeing what he can or can't do. But if you let him do too much of those things, how long before they become just sort of the way he sort of naturally defaults to? And my assumption is that what they're trying to do defensively is like, you know, the very introductory 101 NBA defense that they're trying to roll out here. And it is the simplified version, but just the people he's out there with, like, I think he would maybe look very different if you put him on a team with a bunch of veteran defenders that understood how to play NBA defense at a high level. And, you know, he's actually looked a little better sometimes when like a Marcus Smart is on the court with him, because there's less dribble penetration and things that he has to now go clean up for. And sometimes you'll just see him kind of like wildly leave his man and go block a shot. And it's like, I don't know if they're telling him to do that or that's just the instinct right. Or he could do that in the, you know, overtime elite and get away with it. Or, you know, like, I don't know what's being instructed. So it's sort of hard for me to evaluate how well he's doing it or not. My assumption is that some of the mistakes we may see him make are maybe just like ripple effects of a rookie point guard and Bob Carrington getting beat off the dribble when he shouldn't be, or Keyshawn George not rotating or whatever, you know, like there's sometimes it's such cascading effects and he's the guy that's going to get that ripple down from everybody else. So I think maybe sometimes it just looks worse when it looks bad than it should purely based on his own effort or what he's doing. And I think the nice thing is that there are situations where that's probably happening and he's actually covering up for it and we're not seeing it, because he does have that mobility to go, you know, like rotate over, block a shot and then still get back to his man. And you're like, oh, how did he just cover 15 feet of court in, you know, a second and a half? So I go a little bit back and forth with just like how really to assess what he's doing and how much I should be worried about some of the things I'm seeing on the court. I my gut is, like I said, this is just letting him play for right now. He seems coachable. He's got enough feel on the offensive end, I think, that you see some really smart like passes and things like that, where like if you understand the game at a high enough level on offense, you can probably translate a decent amount of that on defense too. So, you know, the times where he looks lost, I attribute that just being to like a lost rookie around a bunch of other lost rookies. And, you know, I mean, it's not that big a deal.
That point about the perimeter defense is really, really important too, because I mostly the centers are the last line of defense and the last guy that we see trying to defend a shot, whether, you know, when it goes in or gets blocked. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh man, like he got an easy layup. Where's the center? He's way out of position, when in reality it could have been like, oh, well, the guard screwed up the ice coverage and mm-hmm. Sarr's, you know, trying to trap him on the corner and the guard totally gives it up and gives up the middle of the floor. Which, you know, sometimes, like you said, Sarr has the athletic tools to recover and make a highlight block, but not all the time. So it can definitely get a little tricky when you don't have those, you know, NBA veterans always out there executing the defensive scheme exactly how it's supposed to be executed.
Along those lines, real quick, Tyler, like one of the things I've asked, like, so I do my show with a former NBA center. We've mm-hmm. had former Wizard center, Brendan Haywood, Etan Thomas on. And like, I've asked all of them, like, as a center playing high level defense in the NBA, like, when did you feel like it really clicked for you? And all three of them independently said in their fourth year, they felt like, oh, we get this, it's enough hard to like yeah. actually do that. And it's you hear quarterback of the defense and things like that, but there's some truth to it of just like having to understand where everyone else is supposed to be so that you can kind of pick and choose when to cover up for them. So I'm just like, it'll be years before I'm really worried about anything he's doing on that end of the court. And even if it is all just instinct right now, I think, you know, it's still more good than bad.
Absolutely. And, you know, I kind of always equate the like defensive or the career progression for a center on defense to that of a point guard on offense, where it's yeah. like, it's really hard. It's a very steep learning curve and it's a lot to overcome. But once they get it, once it clicks, yeah. that's when stuff typically starts to happen. And more often than not, you know, we get too influenced by, you know, the outlier prospects who are, you know, franchise changers on day one. It's like mm-hmm. in reality, 99% of the league isn't that. It takes a couple years. You kind of hinted at the offensive feel and some of the versatility there. And the more I watch Sarr, the more intrigued I get about it. And earlier I mentioned this year is about the process and less about the end result. And I get really, really encouraged because mm-hmm. the end result, especially with the scoring efficiency numbers with Sarr, they're just bad. But the different ways that he's kind of positioning himself out of the pick and roll and making skip passes, you know, sometimes he's popping all the way out to three. Sometimes if there's space around the free throw line, he's sinking into more of a short roll and then either attacking the rim or, you know, flaring it out to the corner. And those kind of, you know, it's not all perfect. Some of the passes are a little inaccurate or at guys' ankles, but the fact that he's making those reads and mm-hmm. has the mindset to even go through that and doesn't feel overly rushed into, oh, ball, shoot, go. You know, every time he touches it, I think is really, really encouraging. So from an offensive standpoint, kind of how have you seen his game grow from, you know, summer league when he was abhorrent to now where he's putting up really good numbers and dropping 30 plus against the Nuggets?
Yeah, like that summer league game and even the first maybe quarter of the season was a lot of like, okay, I've caught the ball. Now let me retreat to the 3-point line and shoot it. And that's the option. Like that's the one move I can hit on the joystick here on the controller here is just shoot a three. And that wasn't a thing I was particularly happy with personally. Brett Usher, who's a really good follow on NBA Twitter, had like just a montage of just like short roll passing from Sarr the other day. And was like, yes, like these are things he can do. It's not just, you know, the fact that he's like 40% from the field or whatever. Like there's a little more, you know, nuance to it than that. And just, again, kind of like high level numbers you can't read too much into, but the fact like the last six games, he's averaging 20 points per game on 45% from the field and 43% from three and 90% from the free throw line. Like that's a decent enough sample size for me in the minutes he's playing to feel good about, you know, what he's doing with that. And if you stretch it over to just like the last 10 games, he's still at 18 points and, you know, above 40%, from the field and, you know, around 40% from three. So like 10 games isn't huge, but it's enough of the season to feel like things are trending in a more positive direction. And I do think some of that is finally like they're asking him to be the roll man in a pick and roll and just like do simple stuff around the rim and get a few easy ones and then maybe get to the free throw line and then back his way out. And, you know, he's been more of a driver or he'll attack a closeout more. He's hitting enough threes that they actually have to close out on him instead of just like turn and get ready to rebound. So I think we're seeing progression and that's really all I wanted to see. To me, it was really confusing why, like I always said, I'd like to see Sarr be more of like a vertical spacer or some kind of lob threat. And it's like, well, that's not really his skill set. He doesn't do that. It's like, oh, okay, well, why? He covers he's a lot of ground.
Athletic on defense. Enough
to. Yeah, he's a good athlete. He's long. He's got, the hands are sometimes a little questionable, and it's maybe one thing worth talking about, but they're not terrible. Like, he's not going to drop every pass. Like, if you throw him a lob, I think he can catch it. So I never really understood why we didn't see more of that. And some of that is maybe personnel. Like, the Wizards overall lack for guys like breaking down a defense enough and being like a walking paint touch. Like, that's what I'd love to see them get in one of these next couple drafts. Like, Bub doesn't really do it, get to the rim. Even Poole, like, doesn't do it as much as you'd like. And there are weeks where he's like really good about it, and then he won't do it for a while. So, maybe a more dynamic point guard, like if they'd have drafted an Isaiah Collier or somebody who could get into the rim or get in the lane a little bit more, does that open some things up for Sar? You know, that's just kind of the musings I have on like how he could be used differently, but it would just be nice to see him get a few freebies and not have to worry about the shooting percentage. And one of the things that kills me is that he just, like, he'll be 8 feet from the rim and he'll fade away, or he'll try to shoot a floater over a 6'7" guy. And just like, yep. what are you doing? And it's great to have touch. Like, I'd love to see him make more of those if he's going to do them at the very least. But it's something that I hope that in film, they're just like beating him over the head, you know, just like, no, don't do that. Like, take that shot away from your arsenal for the next 2 years. And that's a break in case of emergency if you have no other option kind of thing. But every once in a while, he'll like dunk on somebody and just like, yeah, do that more. Like, you can do it. So that's the one that confuses me more than anything else. It's just like, what are they trying to get him to do versus what is he actually able to do? And because he's not doing enough of it, does it mean he can't, or they're not imploring him to do it? I like the idea of trying to play five out and being able to do that and things like that longer term, but you're 7 feet tall. At some point, I'd like to see you do some, you know, centery type things from time to time.
I love that you brought that up, because that was my biggest gripe with him coming into the draft, where it's like, yeah, the shooting numbers aren't good, but I'm encouraged enough that I could see this being a tool, but they're bad and you just use them relentlessly and you don't get the easy stuff. Like, you're a long, athletic, explosive athlete and you're fading away from 10 feet away. Like, just power, you know, pound dribble, finish with your a little baby hook, you know, something going towards the basket.
Just one move and maybe one counter. Like, just
something simple. That. Like, and you never see him just like lower his shoulder, regardless of like, if Embiid's healthy and he's defending Sar in the post and you're not doing that, cool. Okay, whatever. Yeah. I get it. But when you get the opposing point guard switched on you, why are you fading away? Like, what are we doing? And we're seeing that consistently. Even in his shot selection this year, where he's in the 72nd percentile in 3-point frequency at his position, the 73rd percentile in mid-range shot frequency at his position, and just the 18th percentile in shots at the rim. And that's just, it's not a winning, long-term winning formula, unless that 3-point shot and that jumper is really such legitimate, which it's not yet. So it's like, I am totally with you, and I love that you brought it up, because it's like, can we just get some of the easy stuff? Can we get something just easy at the rim? You're huge, you're explosive, get a dunk every now and then, you have decent scoring touch, get a little layup, perfect a one dribble baby hook, you know, over your left shoulder. And we've just never ever seen that from him, and that's going back a couple years, which I do worry about in terms of that mentality, because, you know, it's developing a skill or putting on weight or getting stronger. That stuff is easier. Sure. Like, we see that done constantly, but shifting a mindset and trying to make someone more physical and play in a way that they never have before, that can be really, really difficult.
Yeah. That's the biggest project for this front office. I think, well, actually this coaching staff probably more like it, is to figure out, okay, we've drafted all these toolsy guys. How do we, like, they all kind of need the mentality shift in some respect. Like, Koulibaly needs to be more aggressive. You know, like, there are different things that each of them need. And for him, I think that's the biggest one, of just like, it's cool that you have some guard skills, but you did grow to be 7 feet tall. Like, let's see it used. And I thought that's something that would improve more in the NBA, where there's a little more open, a little more run and gun. He'd get some like run outs, and with some space, he'd be harder for slower bigs to keep in front of him, but they eventually catch up enough that they can just bump him back off a spot. And instead of then trying to use that, you know, agility more, he just, okay, cool, I'll fade. Like, that's the easy bailout. And I would almost have a rule with him where, like, it's 1-to-1. Like, if you take 1 3-point attempt, I want to see 1 dunk attempt or one shot within 8 feet, or you're coming out. And just, like, that's the rule, right? Like, if you, you know, don't go for 1-for-1 or 1-for-2 or whatever, you know, the ratio is that you're willing to live with, great. But when we see games where his first 4 shot attempts are 3-pointers, it's just like, okay, all right.
It'll be another one of those nights.
Yeah, exactly. And there's one particular game, and don't ask me which one of the ones, but they played Milwaukee, and I just have this very vivid memory of him ending up multiple times with Dame Lillard guarding him, and he was still shooting like 12-foot Dirk fadeaways. And you're just like, dude, what? It's literally probably the worst perimeter defender left in the NBA right now, and he's so much smaller than you. If there were ever a time where, and he's not a guy that's going to take a charge on you either, like, this is your opportunity to go try to put somebody on a poster. And he just never once attempted it. He, like, one back down and then a fadeaway, and then, like, just, I don't know. So that's the biggest thing. It's just, I hope all summer is just spent, like, you know, don't do this. Like, you know, just every time he defaults to it, they should just yell at him a lot, and hopefully that helps.
But, I mean, well, like, this whole time we've been talking about it from his individual scoring standpoint, but the passing stuff that he's shown over the last couple of years, if he just starts punishing some of those mismatches once or twice a game, then okay, now they're sending doubles to you, and now you're able to kick it out to an actual good 3-point shooter in the corner or at the top of the key, or a cutter who has a free lane now. And it's like they're just not capitalizing and creating opportunities in really simple kind of areas that they should be. Going back to the offseason when they made the Valanciunas signing, I kind of had mixed feelings about it because of, you know, defensively, it's like, okay, cool. There's someone there to rebound and do the more physical stuff that I don't think Sarr is ready for. But then on offense, I kind of got a little Denny Avdija PTSD of like, oh God, are they just going to like use him just as a spot up shooter again when that's like his worst thing right now? Yeah. It's like, oh no, don't, please, no, empower him, like put him in situations that he should be like learning and growing in. And now we're seeing that more and more in the second half of the year, especially in the pick and roll. Kind of going forward, do you see him more as just like a pick and roll kind of two-man game play finisher, kind of creator out of there, or do you think that there are avenues for him to take on a little more responsibility or kind of offensive versatility?
There are some situations, and there aren't a lot of them. Like if you went into Synergy and trying to pull clips for it, you wouldn't find a ton, but you see just every once in a while, it goes super well of like, you know, him on the nail and like someone will cut off of him and he'll just have this little drop off pass. And you're like, yeah, do that. Like, yeah. Well, let's run some stuff around or through him. And again, it's way too sparse, but he does seem to do it more with the other rookies. They all seem to be very willing passers to each other, and it's not a knock on any of the vets. I just think he's more deferential to them. Whereas like with some of the other guys that maybe he feels a little more uneven footing with, he's willing to explore some two-man stuff and be a little more involved in what he does and feel like he can take on a little more responsibility. Again, that's just sort of like armchair quarterbacking or, you know, armchair psychologisting him of what's happening. But that is a thing that I think I've noticed a few times now where it's like, oh, okay, Keyshawn will cut off of him. Like, that's cool. And then maybe he'll slip a screen and drop out at the perimeter. And then I'm okay with a wide open three. Like then you can live with it. Or now that I've caught the ball on the perimeter and somebody has to rotate out to me, then maybe I'll re-attack. And like, you're putting a little more pressure on the defense. I think just all of this defaults to so much bailout stuff and that you don't make them work. You're kind of killing your own potential versatility there. And I don't care if he misses every shot he takes the rest of the season. I mean, it's not ideal, but like, I'd rather just see them be in such a like a more productive long-term context that, you know, you could at least be like, all right, I understand the process here. So to answer your question, like, I hope there's more there that they try to like prioritize. It doesn't seem like they're in a big hurry to overemphasize it though. So if they are going to default to this is just a spot up shooter, my one real gripe with this whole, you know, organization right now is like they've made multiple comments about not needing like a dedicated shooting coach. And that drives me a little nuts when all of the people you've drafted can't really shoot yet. And like you go out and get an AJ Johnson, who I don't think anybody would accuse of being like a future Steph Curry. Like they all need some work on their shot. And it's not just three pointers. Like it's different parts on the court. Like if you have somebody that's an actual expert in that particular domain, great. And Brian Keith has just sort of said like, oh, we could all shoot a little bit so we can all kind of help them. And I don't really buy into that personally. Like Keith himself was like a 37% shooter on low volume as a college player. Like I'm sure he was fine, but I don't look at him and assume he's like a shooting savant. And that's not what you want your head coach working on exclusively. So
no,
that's like a, maybe they are doing a great job with him. I don't know, but you just came off a situation where Denny Avdia didn't improve as a shooter until he went outside the organization and got his own independent shooting coach. And Johnny Davis complained about them ruining his shot and him no longer being willing to work with them. So from just a pure like PTSD perspective, I'd love them to go out and get whoever it is. Like you assembled the super friends of front office guys. We'll go out and get, you know, Mark Price or bring him out of retirement or whoever the guy is that you think can help enough of these dudes. And like, if we're going to make them all be 3-point shooters, like let's actually go all in on that. And that doesn't seem like that's happened so far.
Hate that's that's tough. Especially when you look at teams like the Spurs, you know, exactly, in the past, and now the Thunder and
any of the Chip Pelicans England teams, and, right?
Exactly. It's like, wow, all these teams that either, you know, that have really good shooters now typically have a guy specifically there to develop that, because everyone has a different nuanced shot. Just being like, oh, I was a pretty good shooter back in the day, I can help him. It's like, that doesn't tell me much of anything.
There's a reason they all send their bigs to Hakeem Olajuwon to teach him how to do post moves, or even a Kevin McHale while he was still coaching. Like, it's because they were the best at it, and that's what you want them to, even if they're just picking up a few things from here, you know, from time to time. Like, that's better than me saying, like, well, my 6'2" assistant coach, he had a good jump hook, so he can teach them how to play in the post. Like, it just isn't the same.
Yeah, back in eighth grade, I was in the post.
It was legal, yeah.
All right, last thing with Sarr, just what would you kind of grade out this rookie season for him? I know we have like 10 games left or so, but what would you kind of, would you classify this rookie year as a success for him? What are your kind of expectations going forward? And then when we look at the 2025 draft, obviously the prize is Cooper Flagg, who I think would also be an incredible fit on both ends of the floor with Sarr and the rest of the team. But, you know, it's lottery. So let's say the Wizards don't end up at that number one pick. If they're in that 2-5 range, who would kind of be, who would you consider like the prize of the draft or your kind of number one option?
Well, okay. So thoughts on Sarr long term, or grading him for the year. Let's start there. Maybe I think I'd say like a B-. You know, I think that's, like, I can't really grade him on his overall performance. I'm trying to grade it relative to, like, expectations coming in. And he was a raw player, so expecting this polished thing, it was never really, like, this fair assessment. I am a little concerned about it being, like, a 40% field goal percentage for the year. Like, the three-point percentage being low, I ultimately don't care about. And I actually think the three looks a little more fluid recently too. And maybe that's just me convincing myself that because it's going in more, but there's a little less of like a sort of like side hand flick kind of thing where his hands sort of jolting out. So maybe they've cleaned a few things up with him and the shooting, coaching is working. I don't know, but he was always going to be better on defense than offense. He's been better on defense than offense. And I think more of the complaints I have about, you know, what he's done offensively or just the way, you know, like we talked about the way they're using him. So I think this summer they can get in the lab a lot and just say, we've got data now. These are the things you did well. And I think a lot of guys, sometimes they come in now in this generation, is what I hear from friends who coach at, you know, the college and high school levels, of just, you've almost got to show them that the things they want to do don't work before you can take it off the menu for them. So now they've got a lot of data to be able to say, this really is not your bread and butter. But hey, when you were the short roll kind of guy, like, look how good our offense looked. Or you were just rolling to the basket trying to catch lobs. Like, you didn't make a lot of them, but you got to the foul line a lot. And like, if you've got enough like things to back that up or clips to show them, you know, maybe that's easier to figure out. So I think that's why I'd give him kind of like a B minus. So some of that's him, and he's got to want to just break the offense sometimes and drive to the hoop. Like, that'd be cool. But overall, it's just more good than bad, I think. Where he goes long term, you know, next year, I expected to see like a little bit more disciplined defense. I think the other guys around him will be better and older, so he won't have to sort of like break the play as much. Offensively, I hope they use him a little bit more in the ways we're starting to see, you know, that we talked about here in the second part of the season here, a little bit more. Hope the threes go in from the start and he's got a little confidence behind it. And then he can do, you know, a little bit more things like attacking those closeouts. So I just think it'll be more of the same, probably another learning building year. And I do think who they draft could have a real, you know, impact on some of the things he's able to do. For me, like a Dylan Harper, a guy that can get into the lane and is a good driver, but a willing enough passer, especially if he has, you know, better guys around him. Like, you know, not to like, was it Nick Martini? What's the other, you know, the stretch big on Rutgers? Like, I think Alex R is just a little bit better than that personally. No offense to him.
Yeah,
just a bit. So I think if you've got Harper that's getting downhill and can look for Sar a little bit, and Sar can kind of follow in behind him, you know, maybe there's some opportunities there for them to do some cool stuff in a two-man game. And then maybe that opens up some more stuff for Jordan Poole. And like, you know, so he's not getting all this attention. So I just think one more dynamic playmaker would open up a lot. So I'd love to see that of the guys relatively in their range. I don't know who else could do that. I think a Trey Johnson maybe is somebody that could, you know, be a little bit more effective about getting toward the rim in an open NBA floor. Yakushonis is a willing passer and pretty devastating, I think, sometimes in the pick and roll. So a two-man game with him and Sar might be pretty interesting. But yeah, I think, you know, if you're the Wizards fan base and you just saw this team tank to the level they tanked, and you end up with anybody other than Harper or Flagg, it's going to be a pretty tough summer for a lot of us mentally here with them, I guess.
Fair enough. All right,
do you have an ideal fit?
I mean, Cooper's one.
Yeah, sure. That's the no-brainer. I didn't mention it for that.
Yeah, and I think Harper's probably two for me. He's so physical, so versatile. You know, everyone always kind of talks about his offense too. I think he's such a better playmaker than he kind of gets credit for. Mm-hmm. I think he's a much better defender than he gets credit for. I saw him at Hoop Summit last year. It's like, holy crap, this dude moves his feet. He's strong. He sits down in a stance. So, you know, so a lot of those perimeter defensive issues we talked about, earlier, I think those go away pretty quickly. But then I'm still higher on Ace Bailey than most. I think he's still awesome, and I think he's got a lot of defensive stuff that people seem to completely ignore, and they focus on the shot making or the shot taking and ignore the shot making, I guess. But again, it kind of in a better context, I think he would be really, really fun. And as kind of like a stretch four next to Sar, I think that could actually be really, really intriguing. And having both those kind of guys patrol the baseline as weak side rim protectors could be a lot of fun. Does it improve the decision making and the playmaking of the team? No, but you know, maybe Bob takes another step, maybe Keyshawn, you know, takes another step in that realm. But if they even fall, you know, I do like Kasperis a lot still. I know the shooting's kind of struggled, but the dude's a pro. He's so good.
The Bailey one's interesting. Sorry, I hadn't really thought about it a ton, but I do think they should emphasize getting some guard that gets into the lane a little bit more if you've got the two of them, just because I'm picturing them PJ's letting Bailey float
incredible
away.
Again, downhill. Yeah.
Yeah. Like just, you know, him, like the three, all of them just orbiting the perimeter and nobody like ever getting the teeth of the defense would make me a little nervous. But I think long-term, if you had the right pieces around them, then you could really do some interesting five out stuff, you know, 2-3 years down the road kind of thing.
Yeah, and just to throw a little love towards VJ Edgecombe too, because I hit his rim pressure as the year progressed got so much better. Sure. I have questions about the left hand, the playmaking, all that kind of stuff. But with Bub, if he's your true, you know, kind of traditional point guard, having VJ in more of a cutting spot up, you know, second side creator role, able to get downhill and then be a insane defender on the other end, that'd be another very, 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 very fun name to keep an eye on. And then you get, you know, the highlight package with the dunks too. And who doesn't love?
I love a good dunk.
Who doesn't love a good poster every now and then? Exactly. All right. To wrap up with this team, I have to be selfish. I have to ask about AJ Johnson. He was one of my darlings. In the last cycle, I was higher than anyone else on him. I had him at the end of the lottery. I think I had him at like 14, maybe 15, maybe just outside. The numbers in the NBL were awful because he played like 2 minutes a game, but I bought the process, the improvement, the skill set. Now that he's actually kind of getting some run, you know, he showed some flashes with the G League with Milwaukee, but it's the G League and, you know, whatever. But he's actually gotten some run here with the Wizards these last couple weeks. What's kind of been your impression of AJ? Because before we hit recording, you're like, didn't love him coming into the year. So has that changed at all, or any intrigue, excitement with him there?
No, I'm like very happy to say when I was like kind of off base on somebody and I was like, okay, like we're really going to draft like Hamadou Diallo 2.0 of this, like really athletic guy that can't dribble, pass or shoot. Like, this is what we're doing. But he's not that. I think there's more playmaking there than I gave him credit for. And it's still really raw. And the process is really raw in general. Like, it's just, I am fast and I am quick. So I will drive places and sometimes I'll dump it off to somebody, but that's been working more times than not. And, you know, I think he had like a 5-turnover game, but then followed it up with a 0-turnover game where he played more minutes and you could see him sort of like learning on the fly. And I think that's an exciting thing for a young dude. They needed just an infusion of athleticism on the perimeter in general. And that's maybe the thing I sort of underrated in general. Just like, again, Poole been really good this year, but I don't think anyone would describe him as like this dynamic athlete. And similarly for Bub, like that's just not really his thing. And even Keyshawn, not really like this crazy athlete. They're different kinds of athletes, right? Like, but they're not the explosive, you know, run jump athlete. So having just somebody on the perimeter that can do those things is intriguing. I thought he was so raw that it would be second contract before you'd see anything from him. But I think we've already seen enough now to just think he's an interesting piece for next year. And I want to see, you know, more of those kinds of things. I was like bummed when Jared Butler got traded away, but like in the grand scheme of things, I'd much rather those minutes be going to somebody like AJ Johnson the rest of the way here. He's made a decent amount of shots, you know, from the perimeter. Like he's shooting, I think sub 40% from inside the 3-point line for the season across NBA and G League games combined, which is not great, but I think some of that comes with strength and things like that too. So he'll finish a lot of that, but if he can at least just, you know, hit 36% of his threes or wherever he's at right now, okay, now I've got to guard him out there enough that, okay, now he can kind of put, you know, attack my back foot and things like that. So like, or attack my top foot, you know, like just, he can actually do the things he's really good at right now, which is just being explosive. And I think that's just like a fun dynamic to have.
I loved that they got him as like a throw-in in that Kuzma trade. I didn't think he would see a minute of NBA time this year. And my
that's why I wasn't psyched about him being the throw-in in the trade.
He's
going to
be a multi-year guy. Like right. You're hoping year three you start to see something because he's so skinny. Mm-hmm. But like the athletic tools are there, the improvement, the flashes, it's all really fun. But it's like, man, if you expect anything from this dude the first 2 years of his career,
good luck.
You're going to be disappointed. So it's like, you know, it's like, oh, now he's with the Wizards who are, you know, sorry, but actively bad.
Intentional, so we can take it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like, okay, now we're actually able to get a little bit of run here and showcase, you know, and it's like, oh man, I just, the flashes. And then it's like, all right, 2 years from now, when he adds 10, 15, 20 pounds, right. It's like, there could be a lot of really fun stuff. He could flame out, who knows, but I love that they at least took the flyer on him. Matt, this was awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time yet again and coming back. One more time, please tell everyone where they can kind of find your stuff and how they can support you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Like I said, I'm a big fan of the work that you do and the whole No Ceilings crew overall. So always happy to come on whenever you guys need somebody. Believe in Wizards, BLEAV in Wizards. And we'll be talking a lot of draft stuff. You know, between now and June. So Tyler, I'd love to have you maybe do a home and home with me here and we'll talk maybe through some of these prospects.
Absolutely. Go support Matt. He does awesome work along with the rest of his team. Matt, thank you.
Appreciate it.